It's the top of the hour, and you're listening to WCOMLP FM Radio, Carrboro Chapel Hill. I'm your host, Molly Matlock, director of the Chatham County Arts Council, taking you inside the artist studio each Tuesday from 4 to 5 p.m. You can live stream the show at www.wcomfm.org, and be sure to visit us and make a donation while you're here. Like all nonprofits, community radio does not live on love alone. And to learn about Chatham Arts cultural events, classes, youth arts programs, and gallery and more, visit www.chathamarts.org. Today on Inside the Artist Studio, you get to meet Pittsboro artist Marcel Harwell Paknowski. Marcel has exhibited on a national and international level, and her work is in numerous collections, which include the Malt Beach Art Center in Tampere, is that how you say it? Tampere, mm-hmm. Finland, the College of Charleston, my alma mater, the Williamsburg Art and Historical Center in Brooklyn, New York, University of Southern California's Thornton School of Music Scoring for Motion Pictures and Television Department, and many, many, many other places. It would take several pages to list them all. She was also the first visual artist in residence at the Atlanta Women's Shelter. Welcome, Marcel.
Thank you, Molly. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're very familiar, I think, with my signature question, which is, what are some of your early memories of Arts Encounters making a really big difference for you?
That's a good question, Molly. And I will tell you, quite frankly, I have been exposed to art my whole life. I'm from a family of artists, and so my exposure to art was constant. I saw paintings on my parents' walls. They looked pretty much like Alice B. Toklas and Gertrude Stein's apartment. It was sort of stacked one over the other. We had lots and lots of paintings of my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, who was a painter in Belgium, and her daughter, my Aunt Marcel, who I'm named after, who was also a painter. And then again, all their colleagues. So my grandparents had an incredible collection that they passed on to my parents. So I just remember seeing these beautiful paintings in my home all my life. So that's pretty much there.
And you actually told me before we were on the air that you started painting so early, you don't even remember the first time.
Yeah, it was a kind of situation that, because of all the exposure, it was sort of a given that we always did art. My parents were very enthusiastic about my talent, and it was sort of like, she's the one, she's going to be the painter, you know, she's going to carry that legacy, which was really very exciting. And so, yeah.
Do you have siblings?
Yes, I have an older sister, mm-hmm. Who was a writer. It mm-hmm. was more, and she became a technical writer, editor.
But still, expression was a big
yes. And now she does jewelry, and mm-hmm. you know, she did photography. So you know, we were always involved with the arts.
Yeah, and you grew up in Oak Ridge, Tennessee.
Yes, Oak Ridge, Tennessee. I'm a Southern girl.
Did that atmosphere have any bearing on
Definitely.
Your work?
Definitely. It was an incredible community to grow up in, which, you know, you're from Knoxville, so you probably remember some of the influences. We were there. We weren't the pioneers of Oak Ridge. My father came in the early 50s, but it was still a very vibrant community at that time. And one of those communities, which was very much like a utopian, there were no haves or have-nots. Everyone was employed by the federal government, basically, and there were all these people from all over the world. I was raised speaking French because I had a Belgian mother. And in turn, in that community, we spoke French all the time. There were lots of French-speaking people. And so, culturally speaking, because of the diversity of that population, and that the people in the community had lived it all over the world, they were demanding things like operas. And we had amateur opera company that was just phenomenal. I mean, yeah. I heard Carmen in the school gym when I was a kid, you know? art, music, and foreign languages from the very beginning in the elementary schools, which is just really amazing.
It is amazing to me mm-hmm. because Knoxville is one of the most politically conservative places I've lived. Mm-hmm. Like you, I've lived a number of places mm-hmm. now. But it was the most diverse population I've ever experienced. It was also the least segregated experience yes. I've had. Mm-hmm. And yeah, a very, very rich experience growing mm-hmm. up.
Yeah.
So you grew up in this arts immersion experience, really. And I assume with a lot of support from your parents to create Definitely. And express. So did you always have a sense that art and creativity were going to be your life's pursuit?
Actually, I wanted to be a musician. I started, apparently, the story goes in my family is that when I was a little girl, it took me a while to start speaking. Apparently, that's very prevalent in bilingual families. Or children that are raised bilingually, that they take a little longer to speak. But I was singing already, and apparently I was singing Carmen before I could talk. So music has always been in my soul. And so I started with piano lessons, and of course in that community we had, my music teacher was a Juilliard graduate who's married to a physicist, and I took piano for 10 years. And I wanted to be a concert pianist. When we moved from Tennessee to the Washington area, I had to audition for a new teacher, and I prepared Dvorak's New World Symphony for her. And she looked at me after I played it for her, and she said, "You can't read music, can you?" And I went, "Of course, I had the sheet music right in front of me." She said, "Well, you're playing in a completely different key." And I went, "Oh my goodness." So I had to start all over again from the very basic. And that was that was difficult for a 15-year-old to start over. So I got very frustrated and I went, well, I was still drawing and painting and I don't know, I won't continue with this music thing. And it took a lot of discipline and I didn't have it, I didn't think, at the time, so.
And yet you found very unique and specific ways to integrate music into your painting. Tell us a little bit about that, because I'm very, very intrigued and I want to see you in action.
Oh yes, and I'm ready. I paint to music. Music has always been such an inspiration for me. And I've always seen colors when I hear music. And there is a term for that. And the name for that is synesthesia. I'm sure you're familiar with that term, but it is, I see colors when I hear music. So my process is one that I will have a blank canvas on my easel, and I start listening to some music that I have selected for the day, whether, depending on my whim, really, could be something completely classical, it could be jazz, it could be rock, it could be whatever. And I pretty much meditate on a blank canvas, and then it comes. It just comes, and then it just flows. And it's as if I'm channeling something else, and it's coming through.
So you never have an idea when you put that first brush stroke on the canvas what's going to happen?
No, no. There are times when I'm so influenced by dreams and visions, and it's as if I shut my eyes and I'm always seeing something. And there are times when I'll have a flash of an image that I'll go, I remember that color. I'm gonna do, maybe I'll use that. That might be a color I'll put on the palette before I put the music on, thinking, maybe I'll go in that direction. But I never do preliminary sketches. That's just, it loses the intuitive flow that I'm really into.
So would you say that you're visually representing what you hear or what you feel because of what you hear?
What I hear, what I feel, what I obsess over, it's a question of everything, all the influences. So, I know that sounds very vague, but it's, you know, a dream or an experience I had during an acupuncture session. For instance, I have this beautiful purple painting that I felt when I was having some acupuncture at one time, and it was just phenomenal. Wow. No, it wasn't exactly the image that I saw, but it was that version. That was one of the few that I didn't use. There's the train.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that we're on the train schedule for Carrboro. They moved the station recently, right next to a railway station or a railway track. sounds like it's in the room
sound.
With us. It is, but on the radio, it's that was a short train, so we're okay. But thank you for your patience with the train. But you were saying that you represent what you feel. You were telling me about the image that you had while you were having acupuncture, mm-hmm. and that inspired one of your pieces.
Yes. He acupunctured my third eye, which is that chakra. The name of it escapes me at the moment, but it's the third eye, and it's predominantly also with the crown chakra of those colors. And it was just a phenomenal flash. And I named it Q-Spot. You were asking me about how I named, and his name was Q, not spelled like the letter Q, but he was Korean, but mm-hmm. I named it Q with the Q-Spot.
What are some of your other, this is another signature question, but mojo moments in painting that really stand out?
Let's see. I have to think about that. I guess mojo moments.
Where magic has happened, and it's just particularly, the creativity has really just flowed.
I was a painter at the Lollapalooza concert in Atlanta. What a hoot. That was hilarious. Someone had found out that I was doing painting to music, and they asked me to go and paint with various artists on the stage. And it was Rollins Band and the Butthole Surfers. And it was just, you know, I'm a little older than that generation. And so it was an interesting phenomenon. But it was just, it was a great mojo moment in the sense that people came around and went, wow, I like that. And at that, when I do painting to music, I paint with acrylics on paper so that it's quick and it's a flash and it dries quickly and it can move and flow quickly. And so after that, people came around and went, wow, can I buy that? Sure, yeah, it's great, you know. And from there, I was able to collaborate with live musicians on a regular basis in Atlanta. And that, to me, was just heaven. Because although I couldn't make the music, uh-huh. it was as if I was, uh-huh. because we collaborated. I will give kudos to this wonderful young man that worked with me. His name is Brian King. He's now head of the film score department at Thornton School of Music at University of California. Brilliant composer, plays the vibes, the drums, and the vibraphone, the piano, and the drums, all percussion. And it was just as if we had this stream of consciousness. We were on the same level. It was just, that's a mojo moment. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Have you tried collaborating with musicians in North Carolina?
No, I haven't. I've lived here about 4 years now, and I haven't had a chance to. I've mm-hmm. been searching. Of course, this was 20 years ago, and maybe they don't want to paint with an old hag like me, you know, but...
you're pretty hip and energetic, I think.
But I would love to. And I did speak with someone last Sunday about possibly collaborating. So I think it's going to happen. And you and I have been talking about this. So we're going to make it work.
Oh, I'm so excited.
I am very excited.
What do other artists, I know that you teach other artists how to paint to music mm-hmm. In your style. Mm-hmm. What do they really need to learn how to do in order to be able to have that same experience?
The main thing is to free yourself of notions of I base it all on non-objective, starting with a really intuitive reacting to music through color, movement, texture, all the basic elements of design. Don't get caught up in realism, because you're going to get a snag there. And that's what I did with from pre-first through college students and various other populations, just to free yourself from those sort of preconceived notions and let it just flow and see what happens. And give a variety of media, have a little bit of background discussion about non-objective work, a little bit of an art history class about abstract expressionism and that whole intuitive time of being in art history, and then let it flow and just really listen to the music and see if you can paint or draw or do pastels to this music, and it works. It really does. Yeah.
Have you taught people who really were trained in classical painting or more realist styles before? Because I'm wondering how someone who is trying to move in new directions from that kind of training, we have another train. how people who are trying to move from those that kind of training into really pushing themselves in more abstract directions
just
might
basically say,
benefit.
Okay, just put that all out of your mind and just be very simple and really true to yourself as far as the basic elements of design. And it comes. It does come.
So, you mentioned on your website that your work is really tough to categorize, and I agree, which is why I was so excited to see it in our gallery. I'm like, this is not like anything else here. How would you, for our listeners who've not seen your work yet, how would you describe it?
Well, it's non-objective, no object. People always want to say, oh, well, it's abstract. Well, abstract, no, you can't say abstract. Abstract is an abstraction.
It's a representation, right?
It's distorted. Mm-hmm. Whether it's slightly distorted or completely distorted, that you can't really have any idea of what it is, you still have a basis from realism. Mine is not at all. It is purely movement, color, texture. There often people look at my work and say, oh my gee, my goodness, I see a mask there and I see a bird and I feel, but we're so programmed in our society to find real, everything has to be real, realism or answerable and
anchored in something recognizable.
Exactly. And what, and it's so interesting because so often I will look at a painting and I look with non-objective lenses or something in my eyes, and I look at something and I'll say, oh, was that realistic? I try to minimize it and look at it as with the basic elements of design. Did I answer your question?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely.
Non-objective, large, I'm a colorist. And you, yeah. Colorist in a digital world.
In a digital age. And what does that mean to you?
Well, you know, we're the modern times now, it's all computerized, mm-hmm. and I'm a traditional painter. I paint with oils on canvas, on a stretched canvas, and so, and I'm very much a colorist. I am, and color is so intuitive with me. I don't labor over color. Color just comes naturally, and I love color. I love it. I don't wear color, but I love color.
I like someone who's not afraid of color. What is your house like? Do you stray from?
I have white walls,
uh-huh.
because I have my work is all over the place. Okay. So it's, you know, to have a red living room might not work too well with all my very colorful paintings. So it's my house is very eclectic. I mm-hmm. have old antique furniture from Belgium from my family to my grandmother's paintings to. Modern Danish furniture to marble top gilded tables for my grandma. I mean, it's a mishmash, a real mishmash, but it works.
I just pictured definitely very bright reds and greens and blues on your walls, but it makes sense with your work hanging on
everything's
your walls.
Everything's off-white. All the walls are off-white.
Like the gallery. So when did you start painting to music? What was your work like before that moment?
Well, my background is I have my undergraduate and graduate degrees in painting and drawing, one from American University in Washington, D.C., and my MFA is from University of Maryland. At American University, I went there in the late 60s. It was a school that the majority of the instructors were with Washington Color School, Kenneth Nolan, Gene Davis, yet they were very old-fashioned in their training. So we copied the masters, we copied casts, we did very traditional back, which I love because I could do it and I could draw realistically, I could paint realistically. So in the late 60s, everyone was painting up, popping up, and we mm-hmm. I was doing impressionistic paintings or sort of Cezanne-ish type of, post-impressionist type of painting. So that was wonderful because I really mastered the technique and mastered the materials until I was challenged probably junior year of college by an interesting Chilean painter, Luciano Pinay, who said, okay, we're going to do non-objective work. And I went, oof, that's hard. It's really hard. It looks easy, but it's a lot harder than because you have to really dig down deep and really go into places that maybe you don't want to go to because you're not copying what you see there, you know?
You have to shift the neural pathways that you're
exactly.
using in your brain.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. But what... At what point did that feel liberating for you instead of painful?
Once I got over the angst of, oh my God, what am I going to do?
Mm-hmm.
So once I got over
that. How long did that take?
Oh, a couple of paintings, I guess, mm-hmm. you know. And it still took a while, you know. It really did take a while because it's, you learn all the basic elements of design, you learn about composition, and you learn all the rules, so to speak, and then you break them all.
Yeah, the orderly
great.
Stuff.
It's
yeah,
great.
I feel like that's when you've mastered something, is when you really have learned all the rules, you've learned how to use them, and then you know them so well, you know how to break them
exactly.
and make it work.
And you know, sometimes I still hear that little voice in the back of my head saying, oh, no, you can't use a dark color on the lower right-hand side because your painting's going to look like it's falling over. But, you know, that's not particularly true. So that's, yeah.
Do you ever get stuck?
No.
No, so you're always able
to... Oh, sure. Oh, yes. Excuse me. Let me back up. Yeah, I'll get stuck. I'll put the canvas over on another easel, and I'll be working on something else. So it's not like block.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a block. For instance, there was one painting. I don't know if you call it. It's called Breakthrough. It's a very neutral painting right now, but it was bright orange. And oh, my goodness. I liked it at the time, and then after a while, I thought, oh, no, this is just too much. And I thought, well, I'll just cover it up and see what I'm going to do. And I sort of did a sort of neutral wash over it, and it worked perfectly. But so I was stuck, and I worked on it for 9 months, but it wasn't a bad stuck.
No. You found ways to adapt and come
that's
back.
Why I called it breakthrough, because I finally broke through.
You mentioned in your artist statement that your paintings also are a mirror of your own life. We've talked a little bit about how your paintings are a mirror maybe of your subconscious, of your inner emotions and spirit. In what other ways are they a mirror of your life?
Places I've been.
Mm-hmm.
I know that might sound really weird for a non-objective painter, but I am so influenced by color that places I've gone to, the colors are just there and they are imprinted on my brain. I don't take photographs of anything. I remember those colors. For instance, when I was in graduate school, I had the honor of receiving a travel grant to go to see the ruins in Mexico. This was in the early 70s. And I went to Yucatan that no longer exists. I went before they developed the whole Mexican Riviera. So I saw the beautiful Yucatan that really doesn't exist anymore. But I was able to go to the ruins. And those, I'll never forget those colors and those what I saw and the textures and the buildings. And it's just incredible. So since then, I've had the pleasure and privilege of going to Tahiti, for instance.
Yeah, that's on my list.
Breathtaking.
Bali.
Belize.
Have you been to Bali?
No. I would love to go there. Belize, the whole Caribbean, those colors are just, there's, I ruined my eyes in Tahiti because I couldn't wear sunglasses. I didn't want to sort of mute the colors. I had to look at them. And I did a whole series of paintings that were just those bright, colorful. You can see them on the website. So.
I know which ones you're talking
yes.
about. And you all can, too, if you visit www.marcellpacknowski.
Marcel
Harwell.
Packnowski.com. Yes. It's
yes.
a nice long one.
Yes. So all of your paintings are a reflection of things that are very internal to you. Mm-hmm. What's it like when you sell a piece? Are you ready to part with
it?
Oh,
sure.
Really?
Oh, yeah. In the old days, let's say, okay, I've been a working artists of 40 years. 40 years ago, oh, I couldn't part with them, you know.
But even now, the purple one?
Oh, even the purple one. I'll, if it finds a good home, I'll do many, many more. There are a lot more to come. So it's not, I don't mind. They're favorites, but I don't mind them moving on. If they find good homes, that's great.
What do you hope that your collectors gain by experiencing your work?
That's a good question. That's one I often ask of collectors. So I would see someone that bought a painting, and they'll say, you know what? I still love the painting. And I went, great, why? Because I can still look at it, and I always find something new and different to look at. And I go, great, it worked.
Uh-huh.
And that's really heartwarming.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe they feel something different every time they see it.
Yeah.
Where's the most interesting place that one of your paintings resides now? I always like to know the life span of and the travels of these works.
Oh, well, I was really thrilled to have a piece in in Finland.
Mm-hmm.
I have a few pieces in France.
Did you get to go to Finland?
No, I didn't. It was part of a traveling show. At the time, I was doing papermaking, a lot of papermaking, and I was distracted with paper for a while until I realized I was really a painter and that I had to stop making the paper. But it traveled all over the Southeast, this particular show. We had an exchange with Finnish artists, and then they offered to take one, so they got one.
I hope they invite you to visit.
Yes, I'd like to go see it myself. It'd be nice.
How do you title your pieces? I've always wondered this process, especially with artists who are working just from pure expression. How do you decide what an appropriate title is?
Sometimes something will really hit me, and I see the title immediately. Sometimes I have to ask for help.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. For instance, there's one painting, the one that... I actually have a giclée of it at the Thornton School of Music. It is entitled Journey to the One. I painted that particular painting to a CD by Pharoah Sanders. Pharoah Sanders is a wonderful jazz musician, sax player, who was with John Coltrane for a while and went on his own. And I first heard him in graduate school at I was sitting in on a drawing class, and this particular instructor, he let me just draw for the model, which I still like to do, just did it for myself. But this guy was phenomenal. He would have, it was really like a multimedia show. He would have a nude dancer with projections of launch pad at Cape Canaveral. In those days it was called Cape Canaveral. And then have wild music in the background, Pharoah Sanders, and then one of the smoke machines and everything. It was one of those wonderful, so, you know, he'd do everything to inspire his students to get something out of what was going on in the class. But that's when I first heard Pharoah Sanders, and I got bit by the bug. And luckily, I've seen him several times. I actually met him in New York, actually.
And the magic has never died?
Never died. Mm. And so that's an example of how I titled that one. Sometimes it's a situation or the music that I was listening to, or homage to someone, like homage. There's one particular piece that was bought by a couple in Pittsburgh called Homage to Richard. And after I looked at it, I went, Richard Diebenkorn. Why did that? And so I named it Homage to Richard. Or homage to Herman, one of my mentors. So it just all depends.
Yeah, again, that reflects how your work is a reflection of your life. Everyone talks about how hard it is to live the artist's life. Has it been hard for you, and what has allowed you to keep creating and to stay so prolific and open?
Oh, well, I can't imagine not doing it. I have been blessed with a wonderful husband that I have been with since 1970, who has been the most supportive force, and always so supportive for me to continue my dream. Through thick and thin, hard times and all. He's always been there, and I attribute so much to him and his support. Supportive family, parents, even when I had children, they always knew that mommy was working, and I never stopped. I just can't. If mm-hmm. I do, I'm a basket case, you know? I just got to.
What do you think other artists need in order to thrive? Are there some universals that will help other artists be able to keep creating their work?
Just be true to yourself. Just keep with the passion. It's just, mm-hmm. don't lose it. Don't compromise. That's the hardest part. That's the real, to me, when you sell a piece, you go, oh, wow, they like it. Maybe I'll do some more like that. And that never works. You know? It never works. Just be true to yourself and believe in yourself and stick to it. It's not easy. It's very frustrating. I'm not going to paint you the picture that it's the easiest thing in the world. You have to feel dedicated and feel the passion. Mm-hmm. If not, I don't know. It's just.
What kinds of doubts might creep in, and how, you know, have you pushed through any doubts that you've experienced?
Oh, gosh. I mean, there are times when you have, there's never a time when you don't have a doubt. I mean, I'm please don't make, it looks as if I'm this very self-confident person. They're always doubt. I'm not answering your question at all. I'm just sort of not there. Sorry.
It's okay. I am interested in how people sometimes get derailed by other forces in their life or other people telling them this isn't practical. Because especially in our culture, mm-hmm. we have sort of narrow ideas about achievement and mm-hmm. what's considered appropriate. Mm-hmm. And artists are considered very, very brave and often very, very poor. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of people maybe abandon themselves because of those kinds of messages that they're internalizing. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you had experienced that and how you coped with it.
Yes, I've had times when I couldn't afford mm-hmm. art supplies and things and I would have to sort of make do with limited space to work in, but it always happened. Even if it was just had some papers left over from a class that I could just do things on paper, I still was able to do it. So,
being adaptive, maybe?
Being adaptive, being flexible. Mm-hmm. There's always the frustration of the working space. I've had a lot of different studios and from, you know, condemned World War II barracks in graduate school that they only gave to the art students. Of course, we would take it to a closet, basically, to, you know, a third of 5,000 square feet loft in Brooklyn. So it's just, you have to be adaptive.
Yeah. Why do you think that art is important in the world? What function does it serve for humanity?
I wrote something down because I really need, I did write something down about this because art documents civilization. So imagine not having that documentation. Mm-hmm. There's nothing. So without that documentation, there's no civilization. And there are times when people say, oh my gosh, that's not art. That's just horrible. That's horrific. Ugly, it's shameful, but you know, that's what happens in our civilization. So it's a documentation. Mm-hmm. Without it, we're lost. We have nothing.
No guidepost.
No.
You also, in addition to being a very prolific painter, have worked in arts administration, mm-hmm. Arts advocacy, and you were, as we mentioned, the first visual artist in residence at the Atlanta Women's Shelter and mm-hmm. Homeless Shelter. Mm-hmm. What was that experience like?
incredible. Really was. It was women and children. The folks there were, could have been your sister, your mother, your children. They had a place to stay. The Bureau of Cultural Affairs, City of Atlanta, were trying to get art to and service these at-risk populations in some way. And it was, I tried to teach them everything I knew from printmaking, and I'm telling you, basic printmaking. You get the styrofoam trays that you know that you get the meat in at the grocery store.
Yeah.
Turn them upside down, and you make impressions on them. But take brayers, put ink on it, and print. You know, or you know, do the old vegetable carve out the potato, and you know, and do those kind of prints. Basic paper making, basic drawing. Of course, we did painting to music all the time, and I often would bring in, at the time when I was working with those musicians in Atlanta, I would bring them in and we would do performances for them, and that was always so exciting.
Do you remember some individual stories about how women who were there reacted to the art and what it did for them after the experience?
Very often they would say, oh my gosh, I haven't done this in so many years, this makes me feel so good. And there you go.
Mm-hmm.
There's the answer right there. It makes me feel so good. I remember running into one of the young girls in my local Kroger store in Atlanta, and she went, oh, didn't you teach me classes over at the particular homeless shelter? And I said, yes. She said, well, I got myself out of my situation, and I'm working here at Kroger now, and I just want to let you know that was the most wonderful experience. So it was great. It was really great. And with the little kids, too. It was just really phenomenal. Here's another train.
I know. I can't believe this. It's just during my interview hour, we have trains coming through. Has the shelter continued the Artist-in-Residence program?
I have no idea. I really don't. Unfortunately, that was a good 20 years ago.
Uh-huh.
A lot of these programs I worked with. Hello.
Okay, we'll give it just a minute. I'm sure this is going to inspire one of your paintings, the sound of the train.
Yes. I think maybe I'll put Duke Ellington's A Train on, and then that'll do it. If you've ever listened to that particular piece, you can hear him going on the tracks. let's see.
If the shelter had continued the Artist in Residence program, and you said you didn't really know,
I wasn't sure, and it was so much was funded from with the National Endowment for the Arts, and of course, we know what's happened to those programs. But I did go into senior citizen centers, in prison, women's prisons. I had the opportunity to go to the Milledgeville Women's Correctional Institution with, there was another fellow artist in residence who was actually an African drummer, a kora player, not a drummer, I'm sorry, the kora, it's a string instrument, and he and I would work together in the prison, and he was frightened, maybe because there were all these ladies there, but and he was quite nice looking, actually, and so he was a little frightened, but it was just amazing what they came up with, and we just had tempera and paper and brushes, that's it. It was very basic materials, you know, and it was just the amazing results, and again, with the music.
Yeah. Did some people paint something more representational?
Yes. And at that time, and when someone is really insistent on that, that's fine.
Well,
that's fine.
When I hear music, often I see stories. Mm-hmm. I'm more verbal, mm-hmm. I think, than visual. And so I wondered if some people saw stories and then visually represented
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What is kind of the link between, or the power of art for activism, because what you are doing is very applied art.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're using art to provide catharsis for people. Have you ever thought of what you did in sort of activist terms?
No, idol.
Not really. How did you get involved in using art in these ways, in the prison systems, in homeless shelters, with populations that are, you know, whose quality of life is somewhat oppressed?
Mm-hmm. How did that come about?
Yeah, or? And how did you decide to pursue that?
It was available. People heard what I was doing and that I was willing to. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people that are not willing to go in those environments. Mm-hmm. And as far as I was concerned, I wanted to. Mm-hmm. I taught for many years. I taught for 25 years. And I had taught in traditional classrooms. But these were all made available through the Georgia Council for the Arts Artists in Residence program. I think we have a similar thing in North Carolina. I've just never been a part of the program in North Carolina. But that particular residency, the Georgia Council for the Arts Artists in Residence program, it would have, they didn't have elementary school art teachers. So basically, we were hired, working artists were hired to go into the schools and with our particular expertise, whether our painters or sculptors or even writers and musicians, we would be hired for 3, 6, 9, 12-week residencies and go into that population, work with the entire school population with whatever and my program was painting to music, and work with the entire school population from the morning to noon. They would provide us with a studio. We would be available for the students to see us working in our studio, and then we would go out and do some community service. What was the community service? It was dependent on what I was willing to do. Some people, I went into detention centers for youths, the correctional institutions, the senior citizen programs, and etc.
Yeah. Did your approach to the paintings that you create change because of those experiences?
Oh, definitely. They were really a big influence. Oh, yeah. Everything influences me. So I can't tell you, I can't pinpoint right to the spot what particular piece and which one, but I know that there was an influence, always an influence, mm-hmm. whether it was a color or a movement or a texture even.
Were there individuals that you remembered or thought of when you started creating new pieces, especially following your time at the shelter, where you probably had time to get to know some of the residents?
I remember one particular painting. It was a turquoise and green. It was just a very large, dark painting that mm-hmm. I painted after working in the homeless shelter. Yes, I do remember. But it was a major influence.
Yeah. What do you need your atmosphere to be like? You know, I know that you're expanding your studio.
Oh, yes.
What's an ideal space to allow your creativity to flow? What do you need?
Good light.
Mm-hmm.
Water.
Uh-huh.
Sink.
Uh-huh.
And space. Enough space for me to work on several pieces and space enough to make large paintings. I love working large. Of course, I do small work too. I've done both. The space, good lighting, and all mine.
Yeah, what's the most monstrously large painting you've done to date?
When it was probably about 5 feet tall by 8 feet wide.
Mm-hmm.
When I was doing also live performances, I would roll out huge pieces of paper and go a whole wall. So nice. Very exciting.
Yeah. Where do those pieces get exhibited? I know it's sort of hard sometimes to find the right space.
Well, that one 5x8 was in a show in Atlanta. Large murals that I did during performances, I donated them actually to the schools, and so they have them someplace in some schools in Georgia.
You've studied and taught art history. We've talked a little bit about that because I've been trying to recruit you to teach it again. But what are your favorite movements in art history? What do you like teaching others about the most?
Well, My heart and soul is with abstract expressionism. I've always thought I was born way too late, and this is not a very good gender thing to say, but if I had been born a man and been able to be an abstract expressionist, that would have been ideal. Abstract expressionists were not very enthusiastic about women, and not particularly as women artists. One of my mentors always said, "Hey, kid, you wouldn't have made it because they didn't like women too much except for the basic needs." And that's another reason I have been always so involved with women's organization when I was president of the National Association of Women Artists in New York, and also the Women's Caucus for Art in Philadelphia and Washington that I'm still a part of, and that's promoting women artists. I know I'm off the track, but I did want to bring that into the conversation.
Oh, yeah.
That because women are not properly represented still in museums. If you go to most major museums, you'll see mostly work by men and not women, and women are underrepresented. So I do have that part. You talk about advocacy. That is one of my still major advocacy points that I want to make, get women well represented.
What changes have you seen for women in arts since your time in Oak Ridge?
Well, you know, when I went to school, when I went to college, most professors would say, "Oh, you're not going to do anything. You're going to get married. You're not going to do anything with this." And there was really a lot of sexism. Things have changed. I mean, there are more women professors, there were more women instructors in schools, so that there are more women role models for young women. There are more opportunities. And also in the art field, it's not just teaching anymore. You can be curator, you can be museum curator, art administrators. So there's a large world out there now, which is wonderful.
Arts administration almost seems dominated by females.
It does seem that way. Yes, it does.
It's because the pay scales are low.
Let's not go there. Don't give me all my other soapboxes.
Who are some female artists who you feel like you've really broken through barriers?
Oh my gosh, look at Louise Nevelson. I had the pleasure of meeting her. She was everything that you can imagine. But she broke major barriers. Lee Krasner, she was in Pollock's shadow for a while, but then after his death, she...
What do you think about, this was a discussion we had in our art history class about, she had her work shown in a predominantly male show rather than participating in an all-female art show.
Who were we talking about?
Lee Krasner.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And she didn't want to be defined by her gender, period. Mm-hmm. However, the other side of the coin was that female artists were making the argument that there were so many all-male artist exhibits. And so they were trying to provide an alternative to that by being all female.
Mm-hmm.
But I think she saw that almost as sexist, just kind of staying stuck in the rut of associating art with gender too much. Mm-hmm. Do you have a stance on her decision?
Yeah, that's a touchy one.
Mm-hmm.
I've met quite a few older women artists that said, "Hey, we worked hard in this profession, and we worked hard to get where we are. We don't want to have this separation of genders," and that. And honestly, I really don't want to see gender specific. I don't want someone to look at my work and say, "Well, that's a woman's painting," or, you know, "That's a man's painting." I just really don't want to see. It's so funny, if someone at Chatham Arts actually came up to me and saw my painting and she said, "You know, I would have never thought that was a woman that did that painting," and I went, "Huh? What?"
Really?
She said, "Yeah, it's so strong, it's so bold, and I would just thought it was a man that painted it." And I went,
"Wow."
Don't think I'll go there. But, you know, for instance, Audrey Flack, do you know who the sculptor, photorealist painter,
mm-hmm,
and sculptor? I met her. I've met some phenomenal women, mm-hmm, artists in New York. And she was not very enthusiastic about, you know, particular women's organization because, yes, she put her chops in with men and she worked hard to get where she did. She said, you know what? You all have to go fight in there and you don't have to specifically have just women's organizations. And so there's both sides to the, to the issue.
Yeah. It's something that I find very, very interesting because
Listen, when we were taking art history classes, I had that Jensen art history. There were very few women artists that were even
included
in that.
I had that book,
very
too.
Very sexist book.
As far as challenges that you're facing as an artist right now, how do challenges in the arts intersect with some of our current social and economic factors, or our current social and economic climate, especially locally?
Okay, we were talking, my quip sheet here, the storefronts and those kind of things, you know? I'm just thinking about when I was living in New York, and right around after 9/11, we were able to get spaces that had been abandoned in Lower Manhattan, below 14th Street. And they were offered to us at a minimal rate to use as exhibiting venues. Yeah, we had to go in and paint and wash the floors and clean up things and put in some lighting, but that was a venue, and that's a viable venue. So when I see empty storefronts and I see empty buildings, you go, oh my goodness, and there's...
Gotta get art in there.
Yes, and my dear friend John Mikowski has been doing that for Chatham Arts, which I'm just so thrilled in.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
We love you.
We love John. John is just also a very dear friend of mine, and getting the satellite venues and alternative venues, and this new venue that's going to be happening in Pittsburgh with...
Mariah Wheeler of Joyful Jewel is opening an arts collective in the building between Beggars and Choosers and New Horizons, right on Hillsborough Street in downtown Pittsburgh. And there is much, much, much buzz about that and the opportunities that that's going to lead to.
And that would be, you know, I keep on thinking of these spaces, and during the fall have an art happening, that wonderful dealership that you and I were talking about, the Chevrolet dealership, have, you know, a art festival out on the asphalt there in the building, and have vendors and have people show their art, and it brings the community in and gets the community involved, and it's one that is there are ways of owners of these buildings too, I'm sure, that can get benefits of maybe
people seeing their space.
Their space rather than it being an empty shell. So.
Just had a conversation with a landlord about that today.
Okay.
and indeed, he sees the benefits of arts for lending his space exposure and creating a really vibrant atmosphere that people want to visit and people want to use on a daily basis to keep retail thriving. So now in the Chevrolet building, I'm hoping that the realtors will let me roller skate in there before they put anything inside.
Roller art derby. Yes.
I think that's what Pittsburgh needs. They need a giant water slide and they need a roller derby. I think it can happen. I think all kinds of things can happen. I'm especially intrigued with this idea of art happenings based on the happenings in New York. Because I think that we're a very grassroots art atmosphere, and I think that we make these creative ideas happen that lead to lasting memories, like the Bravo lingerie soiree for the arts. That was Marcel's brainchild, by the way. Art.
That was so much fun. That really was that was a lot of fun. I was at one of the Chatham Arts meetings, and I said, "Come on, we've got to get someone somehow to get some recognition. We got to stop traffic. We got to do something so we can bring in the press or just get people to notice us. And let's decorate bras."
Yeah.
So there were some really imaginative ideas and imaginative bras.
Oh, there were. I love the metalwork one, the pottery one. Mm-hmm. So many. I had hoped people would pick it outside our door, though, and say, "Oh, Pittsburgh's become a den of iniquity."
That's what I was hoping, too, that we would get such controversy that, you know, it would bring some press in. So maybe we need to do something even much more controversial.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Really, really bad.
I challenge you, Marcel, to be a bad girl. push the bar.
Watch out.
Push the bar. I think that as an arts agency, it's our job to push the bar.
Definitely.
So what do you hope that our arts atmosphere locally and the Triangle and Chatham County specifically will look like in 5 years? What is your just wildest imaginative dream for our future?
One that all the artists are able to sell their work, get appreciated, put us on the map, and be an arts center, as a place where people want to go to. And say, mm-hmm. This is the place to buy art, to meet artists, and can't go anywhere but there.
I also want people who live locally to buy art. What would you say to people who say that they can't afford to invest in art? Like, how can we, I guess what I'm trying to ask is, how can we create a collector's market right where we are at a variety of economic levels? How can we encourage
question.
That?
It's a good question. I think maybe have art events, maybe have curators come in and talk to audiences about collecting, about the viability of the arts, and that you're buying your civilization and, you know, supporting your local economy.
I think that's a good answer.
Yeah. Okay. So the curators come in and maybe explain to people the importance of having original art. And
visualize something that's special in your home or your office. Mm-hmm. Or even think about it in new ways. Like we were talking with Christy Yule from Briar Chapel, who wants to have an artist come, an ink artist, paint on bicycles. You know, think about getting art on functional items as well.
It's funny because I remember in the 60s, I'm really dating myself. The Opel had just come out. Remember that little car? Was it the Opel or something? And we had the opportunity to paint it like a psychedelic car. And we had
I saw a psychedelic car on the Circle in Pittsburgh earlier today. Speaking of,
you?
I did. Yeah, I had to do a double take.
On it. Yeah, I've seen that car around.
Mm-hmm.
And we painted that car, and it was so much. I mean, that was so.
I know. I love car art.
So.
Where can our audience go to view your work locally at this time?
Right now, I still have some work up at Briar Chapel in the Information Center.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a few tiny little pieces at the Chatham Arts Gallery, and which is a contradictory. Here I'm talking about doing large expressionistic painting, but I also do some small paintings on paper and little pieces. So
that's also the
Chatham Arts
adaptive artist in you.
Exactly.
Creating new price points.
I love going from large to small, large to small, because it's a good challenge. It's always a very good discipline.
So, and the Chatham Arts Gallery is located at 115 Hillsborough Street, right in downtown Pittsburgh. It's the storefront that's bright green with kind of a rose-colored trim and a giant crepe myrtle out front, so you can't miss it. And you can see Marcel's work there. Again, visit www.marcelharwellpachnowski.com.
Very good.
And Pachnowski is spelled Pachnowski. Pachnowski. I feel like I'm in a spelling bee.
Yeah.
and to learn more about Chatham Arts Gallery and our film events and our classes and our upcoming Bluegrass Experience concert at the Farrington Barn, visit www.chathamarts.org. Thank you so much, Marcel Harwell Pachnowski, for being with us today on Inside the Artist Studio.
Thank you.
absolute
you
delight.
Much.
And coming up next is the Fabulous Festival Forum. You'll learn about some of the musicians who will be playing at the Shikori Hills Grassroots Festival in October, also in Chatham County in Silk Hope. That is an incredible festival. I want them to bring Hugh Masekela back so bad. So I hope one of them is listening right now.
I'm putting in
my request. Yeah, Richie Havens wouldn't be so bad either. But especially Hugh Masekela. And in other arts happenings around the Triangle, at the Arts Center in Carrboro, Shannon Whitworth with Josh Moore in concert Friday, September 3rd. The Pulse in Chattanooga calls this biscuit burner founder, that's Shannon, an interesting and sporadically brilliant musician with a smoky singing voice that reminds me of a grittier Nico Case or a harder Patsy Cline. Shannon's played the Bynum General Store, by the way. We're familiar with her, and she's another just sparkling, wonderful person. Visit www.artcenterlive.org for details and tickets. And submit your films to the Carrboro Film Festival and to the first annual Hear and See Music Video Festival. It's not too late. You can visit www.carrborofilmfestival.com for the Carrboro Film Festival and http://www.hearnc for North Carolina. .com, www.hearnc.com. That festival is going to be, I believe, December 2nd at Cat's Cradle, and they're going to have Solid Gold dancers from the ADF and Aerialist, and a lot of variety show stuff in between the videos, but Richard Jamie Field, who's founding that festival, is trying to make the Triangle the new U.S. capital of music video filmmaking, and I know a lot of filmmakers who are creating works just for that event. So I'm really quite excited. And I hope you all will be too. Thank you so much for listening to Inside the Artist Studio on WCOM LP FM Radio, Carrboro Chapel Hill. Over and out.